Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Carola has convinced Jordan to take her into the Abbey's archives tonight for some clandestine research. Chapter 25. Carola lingered in the dining hall after the evening meal, which was becoming her habit. There was little to do back in the dormitory. Unlike the start of meals, which were announced with the loud shutting of the outside doors, evenings in the Abbey wound down slowly. Officially, the meal ended once the kitchen staff had completed their cleanup and emerged into the hall with weary smiles on their faces, but many of the monks remained in the hall afterwards, welcoming the returnees back into their ranks, bringing them up to speed on the current conversations and debates. Some retreated to more isolated spaces at the tables, with one or two colleagues, for more quiet discussions. Tonight, Jordan also remained, sitting with two of the younger children, one of whom was the girl Carola had spoken to in the stables this morning. He had given each of them a small rectangle of slate and a sliver of chalk, then opened two large books on the table in front of him, and was now quizzing them with math problems. The boy and girl scribbled answers on their slates and handed them to Jordan for review. If one of them got an answer wrong, Jordan picked up his own slate and demonstrated the process, but he would always stop before solving it completely, requiring the children to supply him with the final solution. Carola watched him out of the corner of her eye, wishing she had borrowed one of the books Grievous and Wick had brought down from the archives today.
"I asked the monks if they might have anything in the archives regarding Praetorius Rex's attack upon Shafur," Grievous had explained. He indicated one slender volume. "This is a travel journal of a Terrandon merchant who traveled in Al-Kef during that time. I am hoping to find some mention of the attack."
"That's a good idea," Carola said. "But can you read Terrandon?"
Wick raised a hand. "I've been reading it for him, mistress, while he's been checking maps."
"You've two other books of your own there," Carola said. "Other travel journals?"
The guard shrugged. "Well, no. When Sister Sharon brought the captain's book over, I remembered what you said after that first church service, and asked her about the triad symbol the abbot carries. She told me that the symbol on top of the abbot's staff is the original one from when the abbey was founded. All the triad symbols looked like that back then."
"Indeed?" Grievous asked. "That would explain the design of the church as well, would it not? The father preeminent, his offspring relegated to secondary roles and side chapels."
Wick nodded. "I asked the sister why the abbot still used the old symbol when things have changed. She looked at me like I'd sprouted a second head. A short time later, she brought over these books on church history and symbolism and said I should read the section on the Pelagian heresy and its resolution." He sighed. "I think she's going to be asking me questions about them tomorrow. Mistress, perhaps you can go up to the archives instead?"
Carola laughed. "We'll see, Wick. But if you're not there, like as not Sharon will come looking for you at dinner, so I'd start reading."
She then proceeded to share with them her own discoveries from the morning.
"So," Clegg asked after taking a long pull on his mug, "we've a first name for this fellow now. Tiberius Strabo, eh?"
He chuckled, savoring Grievous's sullen silence.
"And those other Sabrians that came with him, what happened to them?"
Carola kicked Clegg under the table to shut him up, but she had to admit that it wasn't a bad question.
"Did his lieutenants follow him after he renamed himself?"
Grievous was silent for a long moment before he gave a grudging nod.
"Some of them. The five names you found in the registry, Mabras, Narius, Kedas, Draman, and Tritio, all were officers aboard the Conor Audax."
"That was the name of his ship," Carola guessed, "before it was changed
to the Pistrix Cruentus," Grievous finished. "Yes, a rough translation for it would be the Bold Venture."
He paused for a moment.
"There were only five names. You did not see the name Lero as well? Glaucus Lero?"
"No, who was he?"
"Strabo's second in command. He must have remained with the ship in Maipor then, while the captain and the others came here. Of those six officers, four are known to have served Praetorius Rex when he came south. As ships were captured, these lieutenants took command of the best ones, expanding Rex's fleet and his reach.
It was not until after Marbras was captured that we learned the true nature of our foe. Then, as we moved north, driving Rex back into the Frieze, Damia Narius was slain as she engaged 3 frigates single-handed, giving her master time to escape. In the final battle, it was my colleague Verassus who pressed the attack upon Draman's ship, eventually sinking her, opening the way for me to engage the Pistrix Cruentus.
That's 3, Kerla said. You said 4 came south with him.
Yes. Lyro, still his chief lieutenant, was in command of a squadron of 3 ships. When my colleagues and I came upon Predatorus Rex, we believed that he was lingering in that location to rendezvous with Lyro, so we attacked before the pirate could be reinforced. However, Lyro never arrived. To this day, no one knows what happened to him or his squadron. But a powerful wave of storms had come through that area not long before. The consensus is that Verado himself destroyed Lyro for his blasphemy and treason, leaving his master vulnerable at the proper time.
Possibly, Kerla mused. The Kefi have a saying, there's a storm for every ship. Grievous chuckled, nodding in agreement. And the last 2 lieutenants?
Kedas and Tritio, Grievous said. They sailed north with Captain Strabo, but there is no record of them coming south with Predatorus Rex. Finding their signatures on the registry confirms that they were still with him up to that point, which is more than we knew before. Perhaps they were turned like the others and died, leaving neither body nor blades behind for identification. Their families, however, live in hope that they defied him to the last and died with their honor intact.
Grievous closed his eyes.
Hashema grant that any answers I find will ease their hearts.
What about this Brevellan fellow, the interpreter? Wick asked after a moment. Ever hear the name Tregabi before?
Grievous shook his head. As Rex's power grew, the crews of his fleet were supplemented by men from the Frieze. This man Tregabi was likely one of them.
I don't know about that, Kerla pointed out. Tregabi came here with Strabo before he renamed himself. Perhaps this is the last record of him, just like those 2 lieutenants.
That is true, Grievous said, staring into space as he considered it. In any case, I had not heard that name before today. We did not busy ourselves with taking down the names of any outside the Empire who served him. Right, because it's not like a man of the Frieze could be any more important than a roach under your boot, Clegg muttered, lifting his mug to his lips again.
Grievous ignored the barb, rubbing his chin with his thumb, deep in thought. Then he looked at Kerla.
I must read this interview.
I'm working on that, Kerla had promised him. Hopefully I'll have some answers very soon. And it would be nice to get some answers instead of more questions for a change, Kerla thought, glancing over at Jordan to see how the lesson was progressing. The younger of his 2 students, the boy, was red-faced and pouting, staring down at his slate with frustration as Jordan calmly talked him through another math problem. As the boy groped toward the solution, Jordan provided a steady stream of quiet encouragement. I can see I'm not the only one who feels that way. She wondered idly if any of the male monks would find Wick in the dormitory for her and bring back one of the books the guard had been assigned by Sister Sharon. Boredom gnawed at her, and she felt awkward as well. Reading, writing, or talking, everyone in the dining hall seemed to be doing something except for her. She might not have picked a history of triad symbolism as reading material for the evening, but it would have been better than sitting alone, tracing the wood grain in the table with her fingers. The table was old but sturdy, covered in nicks and gouges from decades of constant use. Her gaze drifted from one scratch to the next, noticing that the table wobbled slightly as she shifted position. Loose joint, she guessed. Or perhaps the floor's uneven here. Almost on instinct, she extended her awareness into the wood, drawing the mana into a loose pattern, allowing her to catalog the damage to the table. It's the floor, she decided. There's nothing wrong with the joints. All the damage is really just on the top. Decades of wear and tear. That's easy. She tightened her control over the pattern, settling it into the wood. So easy. Won't take any effort at all.
Sorry that took so long, came Jordan's voice, very close.
With a start, she sat bolt upright, yanking her hands up from the table. Frantically, she stared at the surface, terrified that the old scars would be gone, replaced by fresh growth. But the table looked exactly as it had before, the unfinished pattern she'd begun harmlessly unraveling. "Are you all right?" Jordan asked, sitting down across from her and setting his books and slates on the table. "Fine. I'm fine. Just started dozing off, I think. I should have brought a book." She began to relax as Jordan chuckled. "How did your lesson go? The boy seemed frustrated."
"Darren's not as fond of algebra as Maya," Jordan said, "but he's coming along. I think part of the problem is that math comes very easily to her. She's usually the one to get the answer first, and that makes Darren feel stupid. Now, when it comes to geography and history, it's the other way around." He grinned. "That boy could draw the entire frieze in his sleep."
Carla laughed, wondering what would happen if the boy caught a glimpse of Grievous's map. But she knew the Sabrian would never allow it. "So, are we ready to go?"
"Not just yet," Jordan told her. "We want the hole to empty out a bit more."
He smiled at her. "Want to study some algebra?"
"I'll pass, thanks."
Carla looked at his stack of books, noticing one slender volume on the top. It was rather drab in comparison to the older leather-bound tomes. The books cover no more than two sheets of thick, coarse cardstock, bound in pale cloth, with the title set down on the front and spine in a rich black ink. She recognized the sturdy drab appearance of the blank journals produced by the Abbey for the monks to document their work.
"What's this one?" she asked, turning the book to read the cover. "Jack of the Dance," she said aloud, "a collection and analysis of folklore from Malachi and Terrandor. Did you write this?"
"No, Brother Farrow did," Jordan replied. "He assigned this to me as part of my studies in Terrandon language and customs."
Carla opened the book, curious. It was written in Terrandon, and as the title said, it was a collection of folk tales featuring the popular hero Jack of the Dance, with Brother Farrow's commentary following each one, explaining where the story had come from, then showing similarities and differences each story had to the others.
"I always liked stories about Jack the best when I was growing up," Carla said, smiling as she flipped through the pages. "You know stories are told about him in the frieze as well? He's called Jack Dancer, or Dancing Jack down here, and the stories all take place on ships or islands, but otherwise he's the same character."
Jordan nodded. "He's popular in Malachi, too. They call him Jacques... something or other. Farrow's made a note of that somewhere. But it's not just his name that changes. Jack acts differently from story to story, too. There's one where he saves a village from drought by dancing up a storm and bringing the rain. Then there's the one with Jack and the apple tree."
"I remember that one," Carla said. "Jack's wandering through a winter forest and he comes upon an apple tree. He's hungry, so he dances to make the tree blossom with fruit out of season. But the branches are too high for him to reach the fruit."
She started to laugh as the story came back to her. "So he does another dance to make the tree fall down, but it falls on top of him." Now Jordan started to laugh, nodding along with her. "He's pinned beneath it."
"At least the apples are within reach now, so he won't starve," Jordan added, which brought another wave of laughter out of them.
Carla wiped her eyes.
"So, what does Brother Farrow say about these different stories, these different Jacks?"
"He says that Jack's a thief, actually," Jordan replied, still grinning. "He was so popular a character that many storytellers began switching him in for the heroes of other stories to keep their audiences entertained. The name changes, but the story itself hasn't. So in some, Jack's the hero. In others, he's the fool."
"That makes sense," Carla said. "Are there any real Jack stories? Ones he didn't steal away from someone else?"
"Farrow put one in here that he thinks is original," Jordan said, taking the book back and flipping through it for a moment. "As original as a folk tale can get. It's one of the older ones. You can tell because it uses a lot of words that aren't used in everyday speech anymore. Ah, here we are. Jack and Tom Fairhand. Do you know this one?"
Carla frowned.
"Wait, yes, I do. Tom leaves the family farm to seek his fortune, and while walking along the road, he passes by a bog, where Jack's stuck waist deep. He can't move his legs, so he can't dance his way out. Tom pulls Jack out of the bog, and in gratitude, Jack follows Tom around, helping him on his many adventures."
Jordan nodded.
"Right, and when they come to the palace of the evil king,
Jack starts a mighty dance, captivating the king and his court, so Tom can escape with his true love, the king's daughter.
But Jack gets tired after dancing for so long, and he stumbles, Carola said, taking up the story. The evil king comes to his senses and locks Jack up, setting his feet in chains so he can't dance anymore.
That's the version they tell in Terrandor, Jordan said. In Malachi, the evil king cuts Jack's feet off.
He grinned at Carola's shocked expression.
The Malachan versions of these tales are often more gruesome. But it all works out in the end. Tom and the princess get married, which makes Tom a legitimate heir to the throne, and he raises an army in rebellion against the evil king. After he's victorious, he frees Jack from the dungeon, whereupon Jack flips upside down and dances on his hands, growing his feet back.
That's a different ending than the one I heard, Carola said. I always liked that story, but it seemed to me to be more about Tom than Jack.
Exactly, Jordan said. Jack's neither a hero nor a fool, but a companion, more like a loyal retainer, using his powers to help his friend. Brother Farrow's theory is that Jack started out like that, but gradually became the primary character in later stories. Let me show you this.
He took out a pair of the cloth gloves that every one of the Abbey's residents seemed to carry and pulled them on, then turned to the back of the book. In a pocket sewn into the back inside cover was a separate piece of paper, much older than the book itself. Jordan carefully withdrew the paper and unfolded it for Carola to see.
It's a woodcut print Farrow found, of that scene with the evil king. It's over 100 years old.
Carola leaned in close, studying the picture's detail. She smiled at the slack expressions of the king and his men as they stared at Jack's mesmerizing dance. Then she paused.
How old did you say this was?
Jordan's eyes sparkled with excitement.
Over 100 years?
Why?
Because Jack has pointed ears.
He beamed at her, and she realized he was hoping she'd notice that.
Yes, he does. The king and his men all have round ears, but Jack's are definitely pointed. A mistake by the artist when the rest of the image has so much detail?
He shook his head, giving her a curious smile.
So, what do you think that means? Could Jack be an elf?
How could that be, Carola asked, if the print was made over 50 years before the elf lands appeared? Where did the artist get the idea for giving him pointed ears? Oh, let me guess, Farrow has an answer for that, too.
Jordan laughed.
Did you know that the word elf appears in documents older than this print, going back hundreds of years?
Carla's jaw dropped.
Really?
Jordan nodded.
Some of them are archived here. They're all myths, folklore, nothing that could be considered factual history. But the point is that the word elf isn't a new word. It's an old one. It was in use a long time ago, along with other words like sprite, gnome, or, if you look through tales from Al-Kef, ifrit. All of them refer to a magical folk haunting the remote places of the world, seldom seen by man. If they're ever described, pointed ears are a common trait.
So at the time this print was made, Carola offered, folk would have seen Jack's pointed ears, and they would have understood that he wasn't human. She fixed Jordan with a level gaze.
So what does that have to do with elves today?
Jordan spread his hands.
Nothing, or everything, he said with a dramatic flair, laughing at her impatience. Brother Farrow does have a theory on that. He proposes two alternatives.
He held up a finger.
One, that the beings we call elves have nothing to do with the magical folk of legend. When humans first met them, they so resembled the general vision of what elves are supposed to look like that the name stuck. It's a coincidence, nothing more.
He held up a second finger.
Or two, they have come to our world before, but so long ago that all we have left to remember them are a few old words in folk tales.
Jordan folded his hands before him on the table.
Neither can be proved without more evidence, so we're left standing at Trenot's crossroad.
Standing where?
Oh, sorry. Trenot was a former abbot here, and his name got attached to a term the monks use when you're faced with two or more alternative theories, equally plausible and equally hard to prove. You're stuck there until you can find new evidence.
He sighed.
In this case, I suppose the only thing to do is find an elf and ask.
Carola forced herself to nod, holding back a nervous laugh. She glanced around and realized that the hall was nearly empty. There were only a few monks remaining. Do you think it's late enough to start out? She asked. Jordan nodded as he got up from the bench and collected his books, slates, and chalk.
Head out of here in about 5 minutes, he went on in a lower voice, and meet me under the large oak on the yard between the dining hall and the bathhouse. Can you do that?
I'll find you, don't worry. My night vision's quite good.
Good night, then, Jordan said, a little louder than he needed to, nodding to Carla and heading for the archway that led to the men's dormitory. Carla mentally reviewed the woodcut print Jordan had shown her, remembering the fine black line that surrounded Jack's slender, tapered ears. She thought back to the Duke's Fete and the furious reply she'd received from the assassin when she'd called him an elf.
I hate that word. A simple sound. A cough.
Like as not that bastard knew which path to take from Trenot's crossroad.
With a sigh, she rose from the table and headed toward the women's dormitory. The path to the dormitory was a long portico, and it was a simple thing to hop over the short stone wall onto the grass. In just a few steps, she was out of the light cast by the lamps and moving through the darkness with ease. Jordan was standing under the tree, squinting in her direction.
Any troubles? He asked as she drew close.
None at all.
She cocked her head to one side, listening.
There's no one else on the grounds right now. It's safe to move.
Where are we going?
The bathhouse, he said,
pointing in that direction before starting off. Carla followed at his heels, pleased that her guess had been proven right. She spared a glance upward as they came out from under the canopy of the tree, but there was no one looking down at them from the observatory tower.
Clear night. I wonder if Hollum's up there.
Jordan followed a similar route to the bathhouse that Drusus had last night, moving from the cover of one tree to the next, and she was pleased to notice that he didn't make nearly as much noise as she might have expected for a young scholar, and she had to admit that he seemed to know what he was doing. Jordan paused under the last tree before they reached the bathhouse.
All right, it's probably empty, but we can't be sure until we're inside. A few of the monks like bathing in the evening, though by now they should have headed to bed. One of them caught me in there once, and I had to take a bath myself to convince him that was what I was there for.
Carla shivered. Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Jordan chuckled.
Agreed. Ready?
They quickly crossed the last open space and climbed the short set of steps to the door. Jordan pulled it open, ushering her inside before closing it after him. The interior of the bathhouse was very dark. What little moonlight made it through the small windows produced only a faint glimmer against the damp stone tiles in the floor. Even devoid of the human activity common in the morning, the place was noisier than Carla had expected, the susurrus of flowing water echoing off the walls.
Jordan grinned. None of the lamps are lit, so no one's here for an evening bath. We have the place to ourselves.
He took out a small lantern and lit it, shining the light across the room to the far side of the central chamber, where the wide blue banner hung against the wall.
It's this way, he said, moving forward.
When they reached the wall, he lifted up the banner, revealing an archway passing into another chamber beyond. Carolyn noticed that the opening didn't go all the way down to the ground, but stopped a foot short.
This is the secret entrance? She asked,
stepping over the lip of the archway to join Jordan on the other side.
Why doesn't it go all the way to the floor?
Flooding, Jordan explained. This is the entrance to the hydro works. You know that the monks rerouted a portion of the underground river beneath the plateau to supply the bathhouse with water. These chambers back here are where that water flow is regulated. The river's strength changes throughout the year, so the monks have to make adjustments to keep the water coming through here steadily, and there's always a good deal of water spilled as they get everything balanced. The entrance is set above the floor to keep the water out of the rest of the bathhouse.
He turned the lantern, revealing a network of metal pipes and wooden scaffolding.
We're going through all this to the tunnels beyond.
Tunnels?
Jordan had already begun to move into the maze of pipes and timbers.
You'll see. Just be sure not to touch anything, all right?
The sound of rushing water was all about them, gurgling and swirling through the pipes. After several twists and turns, Jordan ducked low to pass beneath one pipe and stopped at the far wall of the room. He waited for Carla to come up next to him.
One of the first projects the monks undertook when they arrived here was to tunnel down to the river so they could tap into it.
What they found in the excavations was that the river's been cutting channels through the rock for ages, and as the river changed course, the old channels dried out, leaving a network of tunnels and larger chambers. The oldest ones are directly beneath the preservatory.
Let me guess, Carla said. That's where the archives are?
Jordan nodded once, then stepped up to the wall before she could question him further and put his hand up to a certain carved niche.
The door is here.
He pressed something in the niche, and a portion of the wall came loose. Jordan pulled the door open, then gave a gallant bow, ushering Carla forward. With an amused chuckle, Carla made a quick curtsy and stepped through, into another chamber filled with a disorienting maze of pipes and valves. But she quickly realized that instead of a stone floor, she had stepped onto the top of a wooden scaffold. 5 feet past the door, the scaffold ended at a banister. Beyond that, the room fell away into a dark space. Jordan came through after her, pulling the door shut behind him. He held the lantern up, letting Carla see the room more clearly. A set of stairs to their left descended 20 feet to the floor, where an open archway in the stone wall led to a passage.
"Now we go underground," Jordan said as he started down the stairs.
Excited, Carla followed him. The tunnel was clearly a natural one. There were portions of the wall that were smooth to the touch, but in some places there was evidence of pick and chisel. The floor had a similar patchwork appearance to it.
"It seems unfinished," Carla commented. "I had the impression the tunnels would look more like the halls of the preservatory."
"Not really," Jordan replied. "The monks only need this tunnel to serve as a reliable conduit. They've modified it here and there to keep it relatively straight and maintain an even width, and they cut steps in the floor where it might be slippery, but that's it. It's much the same in the archives themselves. The monks have adapted the chambers to make them suitable for storage, but they didn't waste much time on appearances when they're the only ones down here. You'll see."
As they moved down the tunnel, the sounds of running water fell away to a dull murmur. The tunnel ran roughly straight. Carla could tell that the monks had made few changes in places where the tunnel was going in the direction they desired, but if the tunnel had diverted from that chosen course, then the monks had taken matters into their own hands. In one place, they had walled off the tunnel when it curved to the right and had then cut through 10 feet of solid rock to connect to another chamber perhaps a dozen feet higher than where the natural tunnel had ended, carving steps into the floor for an easier climb. Other tunnels branched off from this main channel, some blocked by masonry, others leading into darkness. At some point, they came to an intersection somewhat different than the others they had encountered. The tunnel continued more or less straight ahead, but to their left, an opening had been cut out of the wall, with clean corners where the walls met the floor and ceiling. It was the first intersection the monks had deliberately made.
"Where does that go?" Carla asked as Jordan walked past it.
Jordan looked at the opening.
"Oh, that. It leads to a set of newer chambers much closer to the river. At first, I thought the monks made this shortcut with the intention of expanding the archives one day, but after exploring them myself, I changed my mind."
"Why?"
"The air's too damp, for one thing. You couldn't store paper down there. But then I found one tunnel which goes past those chambers and leads to a locked gate."
"Really?"
Carla asked, her interest piqued.
"Where does that go?"
He shook his head, grinning.
"I don't know, but one night I came down here with a compass and carefully measured the distance, and according to my calculations, the gate is actually outside the abbey walls."
Carla raised an eyebrow.
"A secret exit? Maybe a way for the monks to escape in an emergency?"
Jordan shrugged. "Possibly. It could also be that the monks wanted to make sure there wasn't a secret way into the abbey that they didn't know about."
"True," Carla agreed. She was desperately curious to head in that direction, to see the gate for herself, but that wasn't what she'd come down here for.
"All right, let's get up to the archives and find those interviews."
Jordan nodded and turned away, shining his light back up the main tunnel. Carla gave the dark hall a sad smile.
"Maybe next time."
Then she paused. It might have been a trick of the light from Jordan's lantern, but she didn't think so.
"Wait," she said in a low voice. "Can you close that lantern for a second?"
Jordan looked back at her.
"What is it?"
"I thought I saw something, but I need it to be darker around us. Can you close the lantern?
Jordan studied her for a moment.
All right, he said at last, flipping the cover shut.
There were still a few pinpoints of light gleaming out around the edge of the cover and through the vent holes in the top of the lantern, but that faint illumination hardly traveled a few feet away from them. Carla took a few steps into the carved tunnel, cupping her hands around her eyes to shield them from any extra light. She waited, squinting. And then she was sure.
There's a light down there, somewhere, she said, keeping her voice low.
That's impossible, Jordan scoffed.
I'm telling you, I'm seeing a light. I told you my night vision's really good.
Jordan made an impatient noise and set the lantern down, then walked up beside her. Like her, he cupped his hands around his eyes and stared down the tunnel. He sighed.
No, keep looking, she urged. It's there.
For another minute, he obliged her, making inarticulate grumblings the entire time. Then he froze.
You see it?
Yes, Jordan breathed.
You're right. Something's going on down there.
He frowned.
But what?
Well, she offered, you said the monks couldn't use the chambers for storage. Maybe someone's found another use for them.
Maybe, Jordan agreed. Let's take a look.
Her first instinct was to start down the corridor at once, her own curiosity fully engaged. But she paused, realizing that her duty might be better served by keeping her master's son from doing something reckless. But if I say no, she decided, like as not he'll come down here on his own tomorrow night. With me around, at least someone's watching his back.
All right, but keep your lantern closed, or the light might give us away. I can see better in the dark than you, so I'll take the lead.
Jordan scowled at that, but he grudgingly did as he was asked, holding the lantern behind him and taking her hand as she started forward. The first portion of the tunnel was easy to navigate. It had been made by the monks instead of the river, and was perfectly straight with a smooth floor. Even so, it was nearly pitch dark, even to Carla's eyes. She still needed some light to see by. But as they drew closer, the reflected glow ahead grew stronger, so when they came out of the man-made tunnel into the natural one, navigation was much easier for her. The first chamber that the tunnel opened into had a ceiling some 10 feet higher than the tunnel. Carla felt a faint breeze on her cheek as she came into the larger space. The smell reminded her of a musty cellar. But there was something else in the air that didn't fit with that recollection. Something acrid. Sharp.
Smoke? She wondered, and turned back to Jordan, leaning in close to talk.
They were nearing the river again, and while the sound of rushing water grew louder with each step, masking their footfalls, it also made conversation harder.
Do you smell that? She asked him.
He gave her a nonplussed look and gently touched the splint across the bridge of his nose.
What do you think?
She spread her hands in apology.
Sorry, but I'm smelling something odd in this room. It reminds me of something burning.
Jordan grimaced.
Burning? I don't like the sound of that. We have to check it out. Are you sure? It might be dangerous.
We can't risk any unattended fire in these tunnels, Jordan insisted, not with the archives so close. He looked past her.
There's another chamber further down and around a bend. I think that's where the light is coming from.
All right, Carla said. Follow me. As they crossed the chamber, Carla watched the flickering glow reflecting off the cave wall, and judged that it was cast from several smaller sources, such as candles or lamps. At one point, a shadow passed across the glow and she froze, knowing that had to be from someone walking in front of the light. When nothing else happened, she crept forward once again. Now she could hear voices over the sound of the river. She couldn't hear them clearly enough to recognize any words, but it sounded like two individuals, probably men, their voices raised to be heard over the sound of the rushing water. They were nearly at the far end of the chamber when Jordan touched her arm.
Voices, he said in her ear.
She nodded, not bothering to reply, and stepped into the smaller passage.
Let us try a ratio of 5 parts to 7, came one of the voices, the sound bouncing off the wall ahead of her.
An excellent suggestion, came the second voice.
Jordan touched her shoulder again.
They're speaking Sabrian, he whispered.
I know, she replied, looking back at him.
I'm fairly sure the first voice was Master Drusus, but do you recognize the second voice?
Jordan frowned and shook his head.
Can't tell over the river noise.
She nodded, taking a deep breath.
All right, how much further does the tunnel go after the bend?
About 10 feet, Jordan replied.
When we come around the bend, she instructed him, stay low and out of the light.
He nodded, and she slipped up to the sharp bend in the tunnel. The acrid smell of smoke was much stronger here than it had been in the larger chamber. Craning her head around the bend, she winced against the sudden direct light that now shone into her face, but after a moment, her eyes adjusted. As Jordan had said, the tunnel ended some 10 feet beyond, opening into a wider space, which curved to the right. From here, she could only see the left wall of the chamber. The source of the light that had first attracted her attention turned out to be a large lantern sitting on a small wooden table set against the wall. But there were shadows moving against that wall as well, evidence of occupants and other sources of light. She waved Jordan up to take her position, then slipped down the tunnel to the chamber's entrance. She could see that except for a thin ledge around the sides, the chamber sloped down as it continued curving to the right. Steps had been cut into the rock to make the slope easier to traverse. The sounds of movement, as well as the flickering glow of more lamps, came from below. Raising a hand to tell Jordan to stay where he was, she moved up to the ledge just to the right of the entrance and cautiously peered over. The lower portion of the chamber ended in a wide, shallow bowl that Kerla realized had once been a natural pool, and she found herself looking down at three men who were working around two tables set up on opposite sides of the bowl. Two lamps similar to the one near the entrance were set up at the ends of the longer table. Half of the space between those lamps was filled with books, papers, and open journals, along with pots of ink and quills. The second half had a collection of small ceramic containers, a mortar and pestle, glass jars, and metal spoons and cups. The second table was taken up by a myriad of glass tubes, beakers, with slender metal armatures holding them all in place.
Alchemy? She wondered.
Two of the men she recognized at once. Drusus and his apprentice. Drusus was measuring out quantities of powder from several of the containers, calling out the number of spoonfuls as he did so. His apprentice, pen in hand, dutifully wrote down the numbers and measurements that Drusus prepared. The third man wore the brown robes of a monk, but Kerla didn't recognize him. He was thin and of average height, sharp-featured and quite pale, with close-cropped, light blonde hair mostly faded to silver. He stood at the second table, carefully cleaning a small metal dish, which he then set into a tripod.
"We're ready to test the next sample," he said to Drusus.
"Very good," the scholar called, now grinding his collection of materials with a mortar and pestle. "Just a moment further."
Kerla was about to slip back to the tunnel entrance to report to Jordan what she was seeing, when she saw that Jordan had come out of the tunnel on his own and was now scrambling along the ledge to join her.
"I told you to wait,"
she snapped in a low voice, muffled by the heavy roar of the underground river somewhere nearby. The youth shrugged.
"Who put you in charge? I'm the one who lives here."
He rose up gingerly to take in the scene below, then sank back down, puzzled. Kerla gave up arguing with him.
"Do you recognize the monk that's with them?"
"That's Brother Pharaoh. I didn't know he had an interest in alchemy, though."
"Well, you said he had been doing translations for Drusus," Kerla ventured. "Maybe Drusus still needs help with some of those books. Any idea what they're working on?"
"I'm no alchemist," Jordan told her, shaking his head, "but they do have a lot of equipment down there. They could be pursuing almost anything. What puzzles me is why they're not using one of the labs in the preservatory."
"Clearly, they don't want anyone to know what they're doing," Kerla said.
At that point, Drusus's voice rose up from below.
"It is ready."
Together, Kerla and Jordan peered over the lip of rock to see Drusus carefully handing the filled mortar to Pharaoh.
"Let us see if this formula does better than the last," the scholar said with a weary but good-natured smile.
Pharaoh shared his expression.
"I think that it will," the monk assured him. "I feel confident that we are on the right track."
His voice was high and clear, younger sounding than Kerla would have expected in a man of his age. He carried the mortar to the table containing the glass instruments and carefully spooned a quantity of the pale powder onto the dish he had prepared. Drusus and his apprentice came around the table to watch, but stayed clear of Brother Pharaoh, leaving him room to work. Pharaoh then moved a curious device next to the tripod, which to Kerala resembled a coiled spring, with a small hammer on one end and a long cord tied to the other. Pharaoh clamped the device to the table and pulled back the hammer, locking it into place. Then he stepped back to join the two Sabrians, holding on to the loose end of the cord. All three watched the metal disc as Pharaoh raised his hand. 1, 2, 3. The monk pulled the cord, and the hammer snapped forward, striking the flint. A bright flash of sparks cascaded into the pile of powder on the disc. The powder began to exude an odd pink-purple smoke, which quickly expanded into a cloud as the powder began to burn. In a few seconds, the powder was reduced to ash and the smoke rose up, floating past Kerla and Jordan. The pair rolled away from the ledge, their eyes stinging. Kerla's nose was full of the acrid scent she'd encountered before, but it was so much stronger now that she had to clench her teeth to hold back the urge to retch. Blinking back tears, she looked around, and to her surprise, she saw another person on the ledge with them, some 15 feet further along. The man had been concealed behind a larger formation of stone, but as he too reeled back from the noxious onslaught, he had come into view, and she recognized him. Benato. Kerla tugged on Jordan's sleeve and pointed at the Sabrian with a shaky finger. For his part, Benato glared at them through bleary eyes, angrily waving them away. Jordan proved no more willing to obey the Sabrian's order than he had Kerla's, and instead bit his thumb, then flicked his hand forward. Even if Benato wasn't familiar with the Myporian insult, he understood the intent of the gesture well enough. Jordan makes friends so easily, Kerla thought, shaking her head.
A much faster reaction, Pharaoh said from below, sounding pleased.
Indeed, Drusus replied. We are retracing Trelia's course once more.
He coughed.
But perhaps we may resume this tomorrow, after the air has cleared.
An excellent idea, Pharaoh agreed. Some fresh air and a quick bath before bed is just the remedy.
Just so, said Drusus.
There came the sounds of activity again, so Kerla risked another look down into the bowl. The men had begun to pack up their materials. Drusus's apprentice collected all the books and papers in a very meticulous order, then stowed them in two rucksacks, slinging one over each shoulder. Drusus and Pharaoh busied themselves making sure all of the small containers were tightly closed and put back in their proper places. Pharaoh turned away from the table and stretched, craning his head back and yawning. Kerla pulled back, afraid that she'd been seen, but the monk made no sound of alarm, and she relaxed. Then she realized that when the scholars exited the cave, she and Jordan would be easily visible in their current location. Tapping Jordan on the shoulder and gesturing for him to follow, she moved further down the ledge toward Benato. The Sabrian frantically waved them off, but Kerla ignored his silent protests, clambering past him. After that, Benato sullenly resigned himself to their presence, even squeezing out of the way to let Jordan pass. Below them, they heard the sound of footsteps moving up the stone slope, leaving the laboratory.
"Are you coming, brother?" Drusus called.
"I will be along presently," the monk replied. "I've just seen a curious patch of lichen in this corner, and I thought to take a look at it. You know the way out quite well by now. I will see you on the morrow."
"As you wish," Drusus said. "Good night."
Kerla, Benato, and Jordan lay flat against the ledge, lying in a single line behind the outcropping that Benato had been using for concealment, waiting as the light in the chamber shifted. Drusus was carrying one of the lamps with him, leading the way as his apprentice came behind, carrying the two rucksacks. Kerla tensed as they came up to their level and turned in their direction. But a moment later, the two Sabrians had entered the tunnel, and before long, their footsteps were lost behind the ever-present roar of the underground river. Pharaoh lingered below for another 5 minutes, presumably examining his new specimen, but Kerla had a sinking feeling that something was wrong. Then the light shifted again as Pharaoh came up the slope, carrying the second lamp with him. He blew out the lamp set at the top of the slope, leaving it there for tomorrow, and started walking toward the tunnel. Then, as Kerla had feared, he suddenly turned and stepped onto the ledge.
"You may come out now," he said in a clear voice. "My colleagues are gone, and we may speak privately."
No one stirred.
"Come, come," the monk chided. "I haven't all night to wait. It will go easier for you if we speak now."
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the frieze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.